Thank you, thank you, thank you. And especially thank you to my sponsors, Triple Gem Center and Watch 8-1 for hosting these events all for free. That's true, isn't it? Yeah. So Watch 8-1 are very, very kind. And the title of this evening's talk, a different talk for a different day, is... I forgot, what is it? Okay. How to discover what you really want. Now, many of you in life, do you really know what you want? Sometimes we think we do, but we don't, because when we get it, it's not what we want anyway, so we have to go look for something else. So a lot of times in life, we don't really know what we want. And when we don't know what we want, we go looking for other things and we never find satisfaction or happiness or fulfillment in life. Simply because we don't know what we want. So first of all in life, find out what you want. And number two, you can find out how to get it. But if you don't even know what you want, how can you know how to get it? And you'll never get what you want, which is called suffering. And that's what most people live in life, and it's a waste of time. So this evening I'm going to show you the meaning of life and how to end all suffering by finding out what you really want and how to get it. So first of all, why it is that people don't know what they really want. I'm going to start with a story. In a temple just like this, somewhere in the world a few years ago, in the middle of the night, the abbot, the head monk, was woken up because there was a sound of somebody in the shrine room. And he looked at the clock, and it was just after 1 a.m. And he realized none of his lazy monks would be up that time of night. So he was scared, but nevertheless, he was the abbot. He was responsible. So he got up and he went into the shrine room, and there he saw a burglar with a big knife trying to open donation box. And the burglar saw the monk, and the burglar said, "Keep away! Don't come near! Or else!" Now every time I give a talk, I always try and make it dramatic. But I've never been a burglar, so I'm not sure if that's how burglars sound. But I am trying my best. "Keep away!" And the abbot said, "What are you doing?" "None of your business!" And when the burglar was trying to open the box with one hand and holding the knife in the direction of the monk in the other hand, and the abbot realized what he was doing. And he put his hand in his pocket. And the burglar said, "What are you doing?" But before the burglar could stop him, he took out a bunch of keys. And the abbot said, "Here's the key. Open the box for yourself." "Is this a trick?" "No," said the abbot, as he gently tossed the keys to the burglar. And the abbot said, "All these donations are to help ease suffering in life. And I can see that you are very poor by all your shabby clothes. And you obviously must need that money for some purpose. So as abbot of this monastery, I give you that money. Take it." And the burglar didn't believe him. So he still opened the box with one hand and still looked at the abbot with knife pointed at him in the other hand. And he opened the box and started emptying the money into his pockets. And the abbot said, "When was the last time you had something to eat?"
"None of your business," said the burglar.
"Burglar," said the abbot very kindly, "in the cupboard just above the donation box, you'll see some of the food, Dana, left over from this afternoon. Please take some."
"Okay."
So the burglar filled his pockets first with the money and then with some food. And as he was about to go away, the burglar shouted at the abbot,
"And don't tell anybody, don't call the police, or else."
And the abbot said very softly, "Why should I call the police? I've given you that money, and I've given you the food. Go in peace." And so the burglar went away. And of course, that was a very good thing which the abbot did. That's what Buddhist monks are supposed to do. We're not supposed to be too concerned about possessions and things like that. The purpose of being a Buddhist monk is to help people. And he was helping somebody. So when he told the other monks and his committee the following day, they were a bit disappointed they didn't have as much money that week in the donation box, but they could cope all right. And they thought what a wonderful thing it was that religious people thought more about others than they did about money. Isn't that wonderful? So they all gave him a vote of thanks. Well done, monk. That's what a monk should be doing. A few days later, the abbot was reading the newspaper, and who did he see in the front page? The burglar. He'd been caught robbing another house. And he was sentenced to 5 years hard jail. And he felt sorry for the burglar. But the weeks, the months, the years passed by, and just over 5 years later, the abbot was woken early in the morning by a sound in the shrine room. It was just past 1 o'clock in the morning. He got out of bed, he opened the door, and who did he see in the shrine room with a knife trying to open the donation box? His old friend, the burglar. "Do you remember me?" said the burglar. "Yes," said the abbot, and he put his fingers in his pocket to get out the keys. "Here you are again." And the burglar put the knife down. And he stopped trying to open the donation box, and he smiled at the abbot. And he said, "I don't want your money this time. For the last 5 years, every day I was in prison, I could not get you out of my mind. You're the only person in my whole life who's been kind to me, who cared about me, and showed their concern by letting me have some money and some food, even though I threatened you with a knife. I'm sorry, I should not have done that. I've come back again to steal from you, but I realize, thinking about what I did for the last 5 years, I realize I stole the wrong thing last time. Last time I came to steal money and food. This time I want to steal your compassion and wisdom. Please make me a monk." Because he finally worked out what he really wanted in life. It wasn't the money, it wasn't the food. Just like everybody else, that burglar just wanted to be loved and to be cared for, just like each one of you. And that old monk, the abbot, gave him that care and gave him that love. And obviously, sometimes later, that burglar became a very good monk. So it was a good investment. So if there are any abbots or committee members of Buddhist temples, please remember that story. And if any burglar comes to steal money from your temple, please give him the key and ask him to take some food at the same time. It may be an investment in kindness and goodness. And I love that story because it shows you just what we really want. And sometimes we don't know what we want, and so we steal the wrong things. So in life, if only we could find out what we really want early on in life, then we'd be far happier people. And when we know what we really want, it means that we change the priorities of our life. Is it really the money you want? Or is it really just the friendship and the family together? What do you really want? And if you find out what you really want and make that your priority, then you'll find you'll have a very happy life. But too often we sacrifice the real things we want for lesser things. Just like sometimes We sacrifice our love. We sacrifice our family. We sacrifice the warmth of having good friends for things which aren't that important. I don't know the last time you heard this story from me, but this was in Australia some years ago. There was a man came home from work. He came home late because he'd been working late in the office, fixing up a contract for his business. But when he came in the door of his house, his son was waiting for him. And as he came in the door, the son said, "Oh, we've got another mug coming in. Ajahn Norm, one of my old friends, thank you for coming in. You got a place to sit? Very good, very good." So as the man came in the front door of his house, his son was waiting for him, and his son said, "Daddy, daddy, daddy, how much do you earn at the office?" And the father said, "Look, son, I'm too tired to answer questions like this. None of your business. Shut up." And the son said, "Daddy, daddy, how much do you earn every hour at work?" "Look, I've told you, be quiet," said the father. "I'm tired. It's none of your business. You're only 6 years old. That's got nothing to do with you. Be quiet." And the third time the son said, "But daddy, how much do you earn?" "That's it. I warned you three times. Up to your room." And so the son was scolded for not being filial to his father and not obeying instructions. So the little son hung his head down and trudged up the stairs to his bedroom upstairs and silently closed the door, crying. And when the father had had a cup of tea, and when he had recovered his tiredness and relaxed a little bit from the stress of his work, he started to feel very guilty. He shouldn't have shouted at his son. Even though it was a silly question, that's what children do. They ask silly questions. That's their nature. So he felt so guilty, he decided he had to ask and say sorry. So he walked up to his son's room, and he knocked quietly on his son's door, opened the door and went in and said, "Son, I'm sorry I shouted at you. I should not have grounded you like that. But I had a very busy day and I was so tired. I'm sorry I shouted at you. And I still don't know why you want to know this, but actually I earn $20 every hour at work." And the son smiled at his father and said, "Thank you, Daddy. Now, Daddy, can I borrow $10, please?" And the father was about to get angry again, but he bit his lip. He restrained himself, and he thought, "I've got angry at my son once already this evening. I'm not going to do it again." And I don't know why he wants $10, but he opened his wallet and got out a $10 note and gave it to his son. "Here you are, son." "Thank you, Daddy," said the little six-year-old. And then the son reached under his pillow on his bed and took out another $10 in coins and small denomination notes. He counted out $20, and then he offered it to his father, saying, "Daddy, here's $20 for you. Now can I have 1 hour of your time, please?" I told that story in Indonesia to a Muslim who was doing an article on my visit to Indonesia last year, and she burst out crying. Because she had a little son about that age. She was a single mum. And she was working so hard to try and get by. She realized she too was neglecting to look after her little child who needed you. So really, what is more important? Getting the extra $20 by working the extra hour? Is that what you really want? Or is what you really want this beautiful being with your children? Is it money you want or time? And after a while, when you really look at what you really want in life, so often it's other people deciding what we want, deciding this for us. because they say, yes, you should get on in life. You should get a good salary. You should get the promotion. You should get the nice house. You should get the nice car. You should have the holidays overseas. You should be able to send your children to nice schools, maybe overseas. They tell you what you really want. And how often do you stop and think, is this what I really want? Is this really worth it? When I have to work so hard, I hardly ever see my wife, my husband, my children, my friends. In our modern world, this is what it's like. In our modern world, we never pause to think what we really want. And what happens is life goes by, and we have problems in our family, we have problems with our kids, and kids grow old, and we never really get to know them. Our family splits up, and we live separate lives, and when we get very old, we get very lonely. We wonder, where did life go? What did I miss? A lot of times it's because we never pause to find out what we really want, what's truly important. When you really take time to pause and find out what you really want and what's truly important, then you rearrange the priorities in your life. Just like I was saying in one of the earlier talks, you know, sometimes we want our kids to do well at school, and we feel that they're doing so well when they pass their O levels and their A levels and they go to a university and they get a good degree. But then we find out once they've got that academic excellence, they still have a very difficult and troubled life. Sometimes taking drugs, sometimes just dropping out, sometimes just being depressed. And we wonder what went wrong there. We gave them the best academic education we could possibly afford. But you all know that the academic excellence is no measure of success in life. That groundbreaking book which I mentioned earlier by Daniel Goleman about emotional intelligence discovered that the indicator of a happy, successful life is not the high grades in A-level at university. Because Daniel Goleman was actually surprised when all these people who got first and double first from the best university were not the people who were later on successful in life by any measure. When he found out there were other people who became successful, they never got the first, they never were at the top echelon getting all the prizes at school and university, but these were the people who were successful later on in life, and he realized it was nothing to do with academic intelligence, but very much emotional intelligence, which is why he gave his book that title, Emotional Intelligence. It was the ability to get in touch with yourself and understand the way you are and how you think, and to be at peace with yourself, to have self-esteem, to have confidence, to have a sense of purpose in life. Not a sense of purpose which is just amassing money, but a real sense of meaning. You know, when I was at university, I had enough time to actually ask what I really wanted to do in life. And because I was already a Buddhist and I was already meditating, at least I had some framework to understand where my life wanted to go. And I made a resolution very early on in my career at university that whatever I did in life had to fulfill two purposes. What I wanted in my life was to be able to serve others, because just my own happiness was not enough. I was living in a world with many other people. Already by that time I'd seen some pain and suffering from people who needed help but who just couldn't get that help. People who were sick, who were poor, people who needed others to give them a helping hand. And I realized that there's so many of those people around that part of my life would have to be of service to others, to making a difference in this world. And that's what I really wanted to do, to make a difference, to help. But that was only half the meaning in life, because I realized I also had to have my own inner happiness as well. Because if you keep giving, 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 as I said in that first talk on relationships, if it's always giving to other people, there's nothing in there for you. Again, you're not a really fulfilled person. So I figured out very early on that my life had to be two-faceted.
and if I could combine the two, it would be wonderful. I had to find a meaning in life which was going to be of service to other people, but also to create inner happiness for myself, personal fulfillment, and service to the community. And of course, you know that that's what I did by finding the path of being a Buddhist monk. Immense personal happiness, as you would expect when you can learn how to meditate and live a very peaceful life and a very calm life, a very fulfilled life, without the suffering of having a wife. Sorry, I had to put that one in. And a very wonderful, peaceful, wonderful life as a monk, but also finding that I can really make a difference to other people in this world, which is what I'm doing here in Kuala Lumpur, last week. Really serving and helping and making a difference. And to me, that's what I always wanted to do in life. And of course, there have been many occasions when I really have made a difference. I recall, the first time that I went to visit England after becoming a monk. I'd been a monk for about 7 years. So this would have been 1980, 81. And when I was in England, we already just had a monastery. That was Ajahn Sumedho's monastery. And he took me up touring with him, teaching here, teaching there. And I remember him taking me to a weekend retreat in the fishing village of Oban in the west coast of Scotland. And at this retreat of the weekend, I was his attendant. So I would actually sit in while he was teaching and when he was doing any interviews and counseling. And of course, I was getting very bored, because I told you this already, when it comes to counseling and people come in to ask questions, they all ask the same questions. So it's very easy being a teacher, because there's only a few questions that people ask. And you know, once after a few weeks, you understand the answers, standard answers for standard questions. So I was actually getting quite bored. But every now and again, you get a different person coming in, asking a different question. And so this woman came in to the interview room, and I can visualize it right now. That's these events which change your life. You know, they have an impression on you which, you know, you never lose. And so this woman came in, and she said to Ajahn Sumedho, he said, "I haven't come in here to ask a question. I've come in here to thank you for saving my life." And the way she said it made me wake up. What do you mean, a monk has saved your life? Did he actually dive into the river to stop you drowning? Did he pull you off the railway tracks with a train just about to come and kill you? What did he do? And then she told her story. Her story that she was a student at university, about the same time I was there. But when she had a bit of trouble with her relationships and the meaning of her life, she went to the GP and the doctor put her on Valium. Just a little bit of depression, and the doctors at that particular time were giving out Valium as if it was candy, an easy way to get rid of the problem, putting them on Valium, and she became addicted to this drug. And it never really solved the deep problem of finding out what she really wanted to do in life and what was the meaning of life, because she never really figured out what she was meant to do. But then what happened, that looking for answers in life, she came across Buddhism, and then she came across meditation, and she went to a retreat, just like the retreat we're doing here. And at the retreat, we're supposed to keep 8 precepts. And one of those precepts, number 5, is not to take alcohol or drugs. And when she heard that, she totally misunderstood it. She thought that not taking drugs meant not taking her prescription medicine from the doctor. And of course, that's wrong. If you have prescription medicine, please take it. Now, if you're on a retreat, please take your insulin. We don't want you to die. So it's that the non-medicinal drugs, you know, the narcotics, that's what we don't take. So, but she never understood that. And so she stopped taking her Valium. And it's the first time she did that in about 8 or 9 years. Now, because she was on a retreat, and because it was in a house, a little country house, in one of the most peaceful and beautiful parts of the world, this little fishing village on the west coast of Scotland, no, way north of Glasgow, she could cope. There wasn't much stress in the retreat. So after 9 days on the retreat, she was doing really well, getting over the symptoms, the withdrawal symptoms of this very, very heavy drug. But the problem was that once the retreat was finished, she had to get home. And the only way home was a bus to Glasgow, to the railway station, and then to wait on one of the busiest terminuses of Europe for a train to take her to the village where she lived. And she said that when she got to that station, she almost lost it. She almost went totally crazy. It was everything she could do just to keep herself together and to get on the train and make it home. These are withdrawal symptoms of these really heavy drugs. And then, when she was at home, she said she spent the next 2 weeks just sitting in a chair, unable to do anything at all, as she waited for the effects of that drug to wear out and to release her system, her whole body, from that chemical. But she did it. And she said she did it because of the teaching she had heard on that retreat. Things like, this too will pass. She could bear with the pain, the disorientation, and the total confusion and madness, because she knew it won't last. She knew that from the retreat, just to be kind to the moment, which means she wasn't overreacting and adding her own suffering to the difficulty she was feeling. She could actually just leave things alone, let things be and let things flow. She knew from mindfulness how to just take one moment at a time, rather than worrying on how the hell is she going to make it through the next 5 minutes. And all those teachings which she had from the retreat got her through. And she said after getting rid of those chemicals from her system, she said it was like coming out of a mist which had been there for about 7 or 8 years. She could actually see clearly. She could taste flavors in the food. She could actually feel. She was alive again. And the difference was so wonderful for her that she couldn't wait to come on the next retreat, not to do more meditation, but to see a monk who had saved her life simply by giving these very simple but very profound teachings on how to bear with some of the difficulties in life, knowing they will pass, knowing that mindfulness can take one moment at a time, how we can be kind to every moment rather than fighting it, how we can make peace and just let it be, knowing it's disappearing, getting better every second. With those teachings, she got her life back, and she wanted to say thank you, which she did. When I heard that, I thought, wow, what a great thing that monk has done. And I thought, I want to do the same. From that time on, I said, if it takes me all the years of being a monk, if it takes 40, 50, 60 years, I want someone else to come up to me and say, Ajahn Brahm, you've saved my life. And if it wasn't for you, I'd be dead, I'd be in an insane asylum, I'd have committed suicide. And it didn't take me 50, 60 years. Just so many people have said that to me, and they've meant it. If you look at the latest printing of Opening the Door of Your Heart, which was not the one you have here, which is printed in Singapore, but the one which is printed in Australia, I had to do a new foreword for the book. And it just happened that a week before I had to write the foreword, a lady came to a monastery in Perth from Switzerland, from Bern. She traveled all the way from Europe to Perth, Australia, for one reason and one reason only, and that was to see me. That's a huge airfare just to see a monk. If she'd have known I was in KL, she could have actually saved a few hours on the journey. But she turned up in the monastery. She recognized me from the picture on the book. And then she told her story. She had terminal cancer, anxiety disorder, depression, and a number of other psychiatric disorders. She was seeing her GP and psychiatrist. Nothing was working. She was dying. She was going absolutely crazy. She was a total mess, physically and mentally. And then her psychiatrist gave her the German edition of my book, Der Kuh, der weinte, which is German for the cow that cried. That's one of the stories in the book. Every book has got a different title, which is just they choose, you know, one of the stories and they give a title for it. The Indonesian version of the book in Bahasa is called The Worm and Its Filthy Love. That's the worm in the pile of dung, the last story in the book. But anyhow, she got a German copy of the book and she read it and read it and read it. She got it from her psychiatrist, and in a couple of months she was in full remission, and the psychiatrist said, "You don't need to see me anymore. No more anxiety, no more depression." And there's sometimes a little book or a little teaching makes more difference than you can ever expect. And so now she was cured totally, that she had to come and see me. And so she went all the way from Switzerland to Perth, from Perth finding where the monastery is, which is an hour from the city, and finding me and coming up and said, "I've come here just to say thank you for saving my life. This is what you've done, or what your book has done. Can you please sign my book?" And her book was not like your books. It was dog-eared, it was so well used. And when I signed it, she wept. Cried and cried and cried. She fulfilled her act of saying thank you and got her book signed. That is the meaning of my life when those things happen. Do you want that to happen for you? Is that what you want? Now this is how you find what you really want in life. Because that is a type of happiness and bliss which no money can buy. That is the type of fulfillment which no success in the business world can actually give you. Even if you are in the top 10 richest people in Malaysia, is that the real meaning of wealth? Or is a monk who's got no money but who has such wonderful experiences, who is the most wealthy? I'll put my hand up. I'm much wealthier than anybody else in Malaysia if these sorts of things happen to me. So this is where you find out what you really want in life. Nothing to do with material things. It's all what we call the spiritual things in life. Now the kindness, the help, the love, the compassion. Because those things, they shine so much more than anything else in life, just like that burglar. When he saw compassion and kindness and forgiveness, he realized that's what he always wanted in life. Not the money, the love, the care, the just having people respect you and respecting others. The real meaning of life. So by listening to such things, it actually changes your priorities. So look, if you do lose your job, it's not that important as long as you don't lose your friends. I say that the safety net, the economic safety net in countries like Malaysia is not your savings or your investment. The safety net, whenever there's an economic downturn, is your family and friends. Your community of loved ones. Because you know that if you do lose a job and you fall on hard times, the people who love you and care for you will never abandon you. You'll always have food to eat and a place to stay. Why is that? Because these people care and love you. That's why when I ever go overseas, I never get travel insurance. Not the usual type. My travel insurance is my kindness and my generosity in giving and sharing. And I found that out even this morning. You know that I came into this morning's chanting with a sore throat. I already have so much medicines, and I never paid for any of those medicines. If I become sick, people actually fight over the privilege of paying my hospital bills. I want to make the merit. No, you made the merit last time. It's my turn to make the merit. And that's my travel insurance. That's my kindness. I have no retirement fund. Are you saving up for your retirement? Your money you're saving up for your retirement, who knows, that might disappear. Your husband might spend it all on his mistress. It happens. You may lose it in a casino. You may invest it in Lehman Brothers. So that's really uncertain, isn't it? But if you invest it in good karma, if you invest it in kindness towards other people, if you invest it in just, you know, your family and friends looking after each other, then that's something which you will never lose. And it means you'll always have this beautiful emotional safety net of family and friends to look after you in times of need. And I always say that's the wealth of a person. Not the money in the bank, but their social network of friends and loved ones. That's your safety net. Because that will not only give you food and shelter, that will give you something more important. It will give you the person who can counsel you and help you, the shoulder to cry on, the hand to hold when life gets very tough and when you really need just a friend to look after you. Because each one of us, we do have those moments in our lives. The moments when life goes all wrong and pear-shaped, as they say. When we lose our job, when we get the cancer, when our family breaks up, when our child dies young. We do always have those moments. And you all know that however much money or fame you have, that doesn't, so just because you're famous and wealthy, it doesn't mean you don't have to suffer the death of a baby and cry like everybody else. But you know that you survive and pull through, not because of the money in your bank or because of the power of your name and connections. You pull through because you have good friends who are there for you, who can listen to you and give you wise, kind advice. Isn't that what you want in this world? And isn't that what you also want to give? Just like me, this is what everybody really wants, to be able to serve and also to have happiness. Another time when I learned this, because I learned a lot, I was very fortunate in my early years. I had some very good lessons, and this particular lesson I learned at university in an unexpected way. Because I was the only Buddhist that I knew in my college. So most of my friends were either atheists, agnostics, a few were Christians, but a few believed in the beer bottle more than any other religion. But I had one friend who was a very strong Christian, and we would have wonderful arguments about religion and spirituality, and we were the best of friends. To this day, I make a point of not always having friends who are Buddhists. Because otherwise I would get narrow-minded. So I like to actually to discuss things with Christians, people of totally opposite views, because that keeps me honest and it challenges me to take my understanding of Buddhism and Dharma even deeper. If I just talk with other Buddhists and discuss, we're discussing on things we agree with. But when I discuss things with a Christian or a Muslim, they actually challenge me and I have to look much deeper into my own understanding. And I really find that very stimulating and helpful. So this particular young man, he was a good friend and he was a Christian. And He's said in passing that he was doing some charity work by spending an afternoon in the local hospital for the mentally disabled, just outside of Cambridge, Fulbourn Hospital it was called. And when he said he was doing that as a Christian, I thought, my goodness, I better do that as a Buddhist as well. So I was just keeping up with the Christians, that's all it was. Just, you know, pride, spiritual pride. If they do that, I better do that as well. I'm as compassionate as you are. So I volunteered to go as well. And of course, when I volunteered to go, I thought I was doing an act of goodness and charity. I thought I was giving. And I went to that hospital every afternoon for 2 years. The Christians, they fell away after about 3 or 4 weeks. I kept on going. And those people who worked, I was actually just working, volunteering in occupational therapy for the Down syndrome ward. And I was the longest volunteered student they'd ever had. And they remember them throwing a party for me in the very end, just before my final examinations. They threw a party for me. And they said that, you know, we're doing this because you are by far the longest serving. We thank you for all your service. And then afterward, they said that we realize you're doing your final examinations next week. This is your last time, so thank you so much. And I remember saying, actually, my finals aren't for another 10 days. Can I please come next week as well? And I said that because I enjoyed going there. I actually looked forward to it. Because it was not a service. I was getting so much from going there every week, just hanging out with Down syndrome children. Of course, many of you who do work in social services, in charity work, know you get more out of it than you ever give. And that's not just being smart, that's actually very, very true. Whenever you serve and you give and you help, you get far more back than you ever give. And that's what I did. What I learned from those Down syndrome children was what, for want of a better word, is emotional language. I learned how to connect with other people, not just with words, but with glances. Because those Down syndrome children, whenever I went there, every Thursday afternoon, they saw me coming, and they could suss me out, they could tell what type of mood I was in straight away, and I couldn't believe that. They knew if I was upset and they'd give me a hug. They knew if I was happy and they would laugh with me. And I thought, how are they? These are supposed to be mentally disabled people. And I realized I was the one who was mentally disabled. At least emotionally disabled. As you know, many English people are emotionally disabled. With one exception, where is he? Over there. Because a lot of times we never learn just about emotional intelligence, especially emotional language. We never learn how to connect with people. And I learned that from these Down syndrome kids. That's why I love being around them. And that's what I've taken away in my monk life. If I can connect with you when I give talks, or when I... Oh, there he is. Yeah, hi. He's the English guy. He's the exception. He can emotionally connect. But if I can connect with you, if I give a talk and it's relevant, and if I can talk with you just in interview time and it makes sense, I say thank you to those Down syndrome children, because that's where I learned that from, to feel a person rather than just to listen to what they say. And so when I did that, I thought I was giving, but I was taking. And this is actually what we mean by finding out what you really want in life. Sometimes you need to put aside your intellect and all these thoughts and ideas, which are just what other people have taught you to believe in, and start to feel life. Start to feel what's really important in life. Try to feel what you really want in life. And when you start to get this emotional intelligence going, and you realize that all these thoughts of just wanting kids or wanting families and wanting wealth and wanting the car and the holiday and everything else which the the movies and the TV keeps on telling you to get, you realize, hang on, that's not what I really want after all. You resist other people telling you what you want, and you feel it for yourself. Unfortunately, we rush around so much in our life, we don't have time to stop and feel what we really want. Just the pressures of our life, just getting through one more day with all its difficulties and problems, is enough for most of us. Again, which means that we don't really feel life, we don't really know what we want, and we get old. And at the end of our life has gone by, 60, 70 years have passed, and where have they all gone? I still don't know what I really want, I'm still not satisfied. And many people, they die unfulfilled. And that's the saddest thing. For me, who's done many, many funeral services over my life so far as a monk, sometimes I am sad when somebody dies, but only when they've wasted their life. Yeah, they may have been rich, they may have been famous, but they haven't really done anything. They haven't really got fulfillment. And for those people, I feel so sad. And there's other people who've died really young, 25, 26, but when I hear what they've done, what they've achieved in life, and I don't mean their wealth or their career, but just how many family and friends they've touched, how they've cared for others, the little social work they've done, just what a great person they were to be around, then I never feel sad. I realize that person found out what they really wanted in life, and they did it. 25 years, but they had a beautiful time. And I never feel sad because that was a beautiful life. Short, but beautiful. I'd rather have short and beautiful than long and useless. So you find out what you really want. So please give yourself some time in life. And this is one of the big problems why we never find out what we really want. We're always rushing. We never learn how to sit down, slow down, and stop. You're going to have holiday season soon. You say you only have one day for Christmas here in Malaysia, but you've got Chinese New Year coming soon. You'd have some holidays. And what do you do when you have a holiday? Go and visit here, go there. You're just so busy that many people, I'm sure it's the same in Malaysia as in Australia, when they come back from holiday, they're so wiped out and tired. They can't wait to go back to work and take a rest. That's crazy. So it's a holiday, why not stop and take stock of life? And that's why we've got meditation retreat centers and temples for. And you don't just go to a temple just to meditate. Sometimes you go to stop and stop meditating, stop doing things, stop achieving things. This is why many people on this meditation retreat are getting really stuffed up, because they come here to get enlightened. You're always coming to do something to get something. So this is not a shop. This is not sort of a Buddhist meditation mat where you come here to buy something and go away, you know, with a bag full of jhanas and enlightenment experiences. This is not to get things. This is actually to stop, to pause in your life of always trying to get something more. To stop and pause. And ask that question, what do I really want? When you ask that question, the whole life changes. Because what I really want, yeah, you know, you've got to sort of get on in life, but that's not the most important, my career. Which means that if your wife really needs you, you forget about the contract being signed. You go home to visit your wife because she needs you. Or if your kid needs you, you take the morning off work. What's really more important? You'll find that, yeah, your career will still go on. It may not get the sort of the promotions everyone else does. But what do you want the promotions for anyway? Aren't you already stressed out enough at your particular level in the office? And you want the promotion, and what do you get? More stress. So yeah, you get more money, but you die earlier, so you can't even enjoy the money you save. You're stressed out. So look, if somebody in your office wants a promotion before you, you take it, stupid. I'm enjoying my life, and don't think, oh yeah, but you need the extra money. Doesn't matter how much of a raise you get, is it ever enough? No amount of money is ever enough. I learned this when I was a young monk in Thailand. I'd just been a monk for about 3 or 4 years. And part of our rules, as Ajahn Norm would know, is we're not allowed to accept any money. So don't go giving me ang paos. Any donations just go straight to the monastery. I don't even see it. It just appears in the bank accounts, which is great. But I'm now well looked after. So there is a loophole. There always is a loophole somewhere. And this is a loophole. I don't mind saying this to you because I'm going to ask you afterwards, please never do this to me. The loophole is you can't give the monks money, but you can say to them, Ajahn Brahm, Ajahn Norm, you've really helped me out. I want to give something for you personal, not to your monastery. I'll give a donation to that later on. This is for you. Because you helped me, and I really want to make sure that you benefit from the gift. So is there anything you want? And they usually say the amount, say for 100 ringgit. So I have a 100 ringgit note here, and I want you to tell me what you want with that. I can't give it to you, but you tell me, and I'll go and buy it tomorrow, and I'll give it to you the next day. Now that was a loophole. The first time they did that to me, was in Thailand. I'd helped somebody, I'd talked to them, counseled them, and it really worked. And they said, Ajahn Brahm, I want to give you requisites to the amount of 100 baht. Let me know what you want. Or what do you want? And then what happened? I started scratching my head as I did then. What do I want? And I was such a simple monk. I was so happy just living with my alms bowl, getting the one meal a day, and just living quite simply. And I couldn't think what I wanted. And this man was getting more and more sort of impatient. He said, look, I've got to go to work, think of something. And then being quite an intelligent guy, I thought, look, what I will do, sir, I will go back to my hut tonight and I will think what I want. And if you can come back tomorrow morning, I will let you know. He said, that's a good idea. So he has to go off. So that evening I took a piece of paper and a pencil to my hut, and I thought, what do I want? And then straight away I saw the old piece of paper, which was like a scrap of paper like this. Now what I really need is a notebook. So that's the first thing I wrote down, a notebook. And it was actually in pencil, because that's all I had. I said, look, a pencil's no good, I need a little biro. So the second thing was a biro. And I was writing it down by the light of a candle, because again, that's all I had. I said, what I would really like was one of these little oil lamps, because that would be very good. But I'd also need some matches as well with the oil lamp. And now when you're talking about lights, my flashlight is terrible, so I need a flashlight and also some batteries. And when you're talking about writing things, I really owe my mother a letter or two, and also my family, so I need some aerograms. And I wrote all these things down, and I tallied up how much they were worth, and it was actually over 100 baht. And I couldn't take any of them off the list. They were really important now. And as I was thinking about, I've only got 100 baht, I have to take something off. All these other ideas started coming into my head, and I writed more things down and more things down. And after about 5 minutes, everything I had on the list came to about 1,000 baht. Do you recognize something from your life? And I realized what was going on. Once I started to allow wanting to come up into my mind, it had no end. So what I did, I screwed out that piece of paper and I threw it into the little spittoon we had. When that man came the next day and asked me what I wanted, I said, I want you to never do that to me ever again. I was such a happy monk before you gave me the worth of 100 baht. And now you said you got 100 baht for me. I had all these desires and cravings came up. And never, even if it was 1,000,000 baht, it still wouldn't be enough. just like you. It's a known effect. Every person, no matter what country they live in, who wins a lottery, now the big lottery, not the small lottery, wins millions and millions. Every person in whatever country wins a lottery always buys a lottery ticket the next week. You think, isn't 50 million or 100 million enough for you? And it's not. If you've got 100 million, you can actually find a good use for another 100. That's why the wanting in the world has no end. But if you understand peace and contentment, that has an end. So when I heard that, or rather experienced that, I realized what I really want was contentment. I just want to be happy. And that changed again much of my life. I realized that even in a spiritual life, I don't want deep meditation or jhana or enlightenment, because that's just more wanting. What I really want is contentment. So I'm so happy I don't need anything. And that is the meaning of enlightenment. To give you the full story about the meaning of enlightenment, I'm going back to my history as a person seeking meaning in life. You know that I was brought up in England. It was mostly a Christian country. And I was respectful of all religions. And because I was good at school, now I got scholarships, you know, from the local primary school to a good high school. And in that high school, it was such a good high school, it was the best one in West London, they had a chaplain, like this Anglican Christian priest. So I went up to him, I must have been about 15 or 16, because I was getting interested in religion. And so I wanted to ask him, now this idea of God, now what is God? Now can you please explain God to me? When I went up to this Anglican priest, he said to me, I remember, he said, God is unfathomable. It's like beyond words. It's the Alpha and Omega of everything. It is the ground of all being, the ultimate, beyond words. Now that's the sort of thing, it may not be exactly what he said, but that's the sort of thing. And when I heard that, I said, that is meaningless. What do you mean the Alpha and the Omega? Alpha is Greek for A, and Omega say C. So is it some sort of street directory of Kuala Lumpur? What do you mean the ground of all being? I know the ground, you know, on which you sort of dig the earth and plant your vegetables, but the ground of all being, what does that mean? And I realized that he didn't know what he was talking about. It was just empty words which didn't really have a meaning. And that was one of the reasons why I gave up Christianity, because no one could give me a real accurate meaning of the word God, something which I realized they understood what they were talking about. And then later on, that I remember, because I was a theoretical physicist, there was a great saying of Werner Heisenberg, who was one of the great theoretical quantum physicists. You all know him from Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. But he was quoted as saying that if you really understand quantum physics, you'll be able to explain it to the barmaid in the pub serving you beer, and she'll be able to understand. And I thought, what a wonderful saying that is. If you understand what you're talking about, you will be able to explain the most complex things to an ordinary person, and they will be able to understand it. The ability to explain is very importantly connected to your own understanding. And if I can explain Buddhism to you, that's a sign I understand what I'm talking about. So that priest obviously didn't understand what God was, because he couldn't explain it in ordinary words. So I gave up Christianity, and later on became a Buddhist. And I remember just going up to this monk. I think I was a lay Buddhist in England. And I asked him, what is enlightenment? What's Nibbana? And he said, Nibbana is unfathomable, beyond words, the ground of all being. And I said, I've heard that before somewhere.
You don't know what you're talking about.
Have you ever gone up to a monk and asked to explain what Nibbana is? Have you ever got a good answer? Some you can really understand. So fortunately, being with monks like Ajahn Chah, you did get good answers. This was not Ajahn Chah's story, but it was a beautiful story which really explained what enlightenment is, accurately and so easy to understand. And it also shows you what you really want. It was a story of the five kids playing the wishing game. A very beautiful story which you'll find in that book, Happiness Through Meditation. I should announce that the Happiness Through Meditation book sold out earlier on, and now we have the book Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond. They are one and the same book. They're the same book with different titles. So don't think, oh, this is a new book of Ajahn Brahm, I haven't bought this yet. You do, you'll find two books exactly the same inside, but different on the outside. So it's not a marketing technique, it's just different publishers. Again, they change the titles, as I say. So anyway, this story is in that book. It's the story of the five children playing the wishing game, which goes like this. In the wishing game, every child can actually express a wish, and the child with the best wish, the superior wish, wins the wishing game. So the first child said, if I had a wish, I would wish for the latest computer game. Because a kid loved playing computer games. Very good. Second kid had more time to think. So she said, if I had a wish, I would wish for my own computer game shop. So if I own a shop, I can get not just one computer game, but many computer games, and the latest computer game I will get first before any of my friends. So they were the person who had the computer game shop, obviously much superior than just having one computer game. And the third child, building up from what the other child said, look, my problem is I like computer games as well, but my mother never lets me play. She says I must do my homework. So this is what I would want. I would want $20 billion. That's a wish. And with $20 billion, I will buy a computer shop. A computer game shop. That'll be the first. And that'll only put a dent in 20 bill. I'll have plenty of money left because the next thing I'll buy is my own school. Because if I own the school, I won't need to do any homework. And I can still give myself top grades every year. That will help my mum be happy. And when I graduate from my own school, then I can buy my own university. You know, people do own universities these days, and then I can actually give myself first class honours in whatever subject I want, and I can spend all my time playing computer games at home. That way my mum will be happy, I will be happy, everyone will be happy. With 20 billion, when I later on in life, I'll have so much money, whenever I want something, I can always buy it. Because 20 billion, you can never spend 20 billion in a whole lifetime. So that third child had as much money as you could ever spend wish. So that was clearly winning. But there was two children left. The fourth child, the girl, now she was really a genius. So she said, how can I beat the $20 billion wish? Saying 30 billion doesn't... It's no difference. 30 billion, 20 billion, that just means as much money as you can ever spend. So saying 30 or 40 billion would not be winning. So she thought for a while and said, if I had a wish, I would wish for three wishes. That's a wish. And for my first wish, I'll have the computer game shop. For my second wish, I'll have $20 billion. And for my third wish, I'll have three more wishes. That way, I can go on forever. Beat that. Now that was a real clever girl. She had the infinity of wishes. Can you beat that? The fourth boy beat that. He managed to think of a wish which was clearly superior than the infinity of wishes granted. The fourth boy said, "If I had a wish, I wish I was so content I never needed a wish ever again. I wish I was so content I don't need any more wishes." And they all agreed that he won the wishing game because he was the Buddha describing enlightenment. So content you don't need any more wishes. Now that's the meaning of Nibbana. All the wishes you want, all the wanting, wanting, wanting. Whenever you finish one want, you always want another. That's why sometimes I see people actually on TV say, "All I want, you know, is my family to come over from Afghanistan so they can live in this country. All I want is peace. All I want." And as soon as they get that, they want something more. So content. I don't need any more wishes. Peace at last. And really, when you look at it, you work hard. Why do you work hard? You work hard so you can have a nice house where you can rest and not want anything. Why do you want a nice relationship? So you can find a partner you can just be content with, so you don't need to go looking for another one. And what happens as soon as you find one wife, then you want another one. You stupid men. As soon as you got one house in Australia, they want another house. As soon as you got one car, you want a second car, then a boat. Where is the end of all this wanting? Contentment. This is good enough. So you work hard, and at least when you have a holiday, when it's time to have a rest, please enjoy your house. Don't work so hard. Whenever you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. I'll say that again because that's very profound. Whenever you want something more, you can never enjoy what you already have. So please spend times in your life not wanting anything more. Otherwise, you'll never enjoy what you already have. And that way, at least you can work, you can strive, but then you stop and pause to enjoy what you already have. Before, sometime later, you can work again. But remember always to pause. And if you never pause in your life, if you never stop, you'll always be wanting, 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 and you never have time to enjoy what you already have. That is the reason why we want too much. We don't know how to enjoy what we already have, which means we never find peace, we never find fulfillment, we never find the meaning of life. In those pauses, where we're with our family, just enjoying what we already have, the kids we have, the wife we have, the husband we have, when we always look for something more, we miss the joy, the happiness, the bliss which we already have. That is what I want. May that be what you want as well. Thank you for listening. There's a nice deep talk. It's a very simple subject, but it's great explanation. So I've got some questions here. So I'll do the questions first of all. Dear Ajahn, I'm only 18. That's old enough. What do you mean only 18? You're getting old. Life is passing you by. And studying in a boarding school where most of my friends are Christians and Muslims. However, I'm interested in Buddhism. Can you please give me a brief suggestion on how to approach the Nikayas, the suttas, which one should study first? Thanks. Yeah, the middle-length sayings are very good. And they're in good English. You can read those. And they're brilliant. And you get a very good understanding of what the Buddha actually taught. And also do your meditation when you're in the boarding school, because when you meditate, you will get the top grades, and all your Christian and Muslim friends will think, "What is he doing? He hardly goes to lectures, he doesn't do any homework, but he still gets the top grades. And then they'll be thinking of converting. You know, that's actually happens many, many times. Have you got a tissue there so I can blow my nose? If someone can find a tissue. Aha, thank you. This is Thai tissue, toilet tissue. You can actually blow anything on this. But anyway, you know, okay, just tissue first of all. So, anyway, there was a good example. There was a lady, a disciple in Melbourne. She was Sri Lankan. Oh, that's even better. Yeah, okay. There was a lady in Sri Lanka. When she was very young, she learned how to meditate when she was a young girl, and she was very good at it. When you learn very young, you know, you really get into it. And so when she went to Monash University in Melbourne to study medicine, she every year got the top in the whole university, and she hardly ever went to lectures. And the people in that sort of university were just so surprised. How on earth can you do this? And it was because she was a good meditator. When she read a book, she only needs to read it once. She didn't have a photographic memory. She had just had a clear mind with strong mindfulness. And when she went to the examination, her mind was so clear, she remembered everything, no nerves. First thing, she told me, the first thing which came into her head, she wrote it down, it was always correct. And there she was, she went through university, no work at all, no problem at all, always getting the top marks because she was a Buddhist alert meditation. In Perth, a couple of years ago, the boy who got the top mark in the whole of the state at the end of the high school year, he's one of my students. He learns meditation, comes Friday nights. I just saw him just about a week ago, actually the Friday night before I came here. He's got a scholarship, all expenses paid, to Harvard. All expenses paid. Would you like that for your kid? Bring him to meditation, bring him to the temple. So this is what happens. So that, you know, if you do that, then all your friends say, wow, this is a really, really good thing, being a Buddhist. Ajahn Brahm, about keeping the noble silence. Is talking aloud to oneself breaking the silence? How about talking to animals or plants? You're getting very desperate. Communicating with others via written words. Is this ignoble silence, but silence nevertheless? Somebody sent me a cartoon, and the cartoon was in a Christian monastery where they keep noble silence. I mean, real noble silence. You're not allowed to speak at all. And in this cartoon, one of the monks is holding a ventriloquist dummy. Since I'm not speaking, my dummy is speaking. That's how he got around it. And what's that other sort of story about noble silence? Oh yeah, there was another Christian monastery where they had very strict rule of silence. It was so strict, you were only allowed to speak once every 7 years. And just one sentence, and that was to the abbot. The idea being, after 7 years, you were allowed to go into the abbot's office. The abbot was allowed to speak because he was the organizer, administrator. And you had to actually say one sentence about, you know, how your spiritual progress was going. So this young man, very, very devout Christian, really wanted to live the monastic life. He joined up, and for 7 years he hadn't spoken one word. And the next day he was going to see the abbot. So you can imagine how excited you are. And he started practicing, you know, in his head what he was going to say. Really, really profound things, because he wanted to impress his abbot. But when he went into the room, maybe because he hadn't slept well because of his excitement, his mind went totally blank, and the first word which comes out of his head was, "The food in this monastery is terrible." And of course he never had a chance to say, "Sorry, that's not what I meant." He was only allowed one sentence. So, it's okay, I've got plenty here. So, the abbot said, "Very good, come back in 7 years." So he was just so upset about himself. He had his opportunity, he blew it. 14 years had gone past. Now is his second chance to make amends. This time he was much more stable as a monk, so he had a good night's sleep. And this time he really did have something very profound to say, really impressive. But again, when he went into the abbot's room, his mind went blank. And what came out of his mouth was, "Abbot, you make us young monks work too hard." Damn it. He blown it a second time. The abbot said, "Very good, come back in another 7 years." So he had two opportunities to speak, and he got it wrong both times. 21 years he'd been a monk. He'd only said two sentences, and you just heard what he said. This time, when he went into the abbot's room, he said exactly what he meant to say. He told the abbot, "I can't stand this place any longer, I'm leaving." And the abbot replied, "Very good, you've done nothing but complain ever since you came here." And that's actually a very good story. It's not just a joke, because that monk, even though he kept his mouth closed, he'd always been thinking complaint, 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 complaint. So noble silence in this retreat is not just not speaking, but it's keeping positive thoughts in your head. You may be just this great meditator who never says a word, but inside you're a total mess. Complaining about this, that girl spoke, that man spoke, they shouldn't speak. At the end of this retreat, when I can speak, I'm going to really tell them off. That is ignoble silence. So please be careful. When someone gets enlightened, there will be earthquakes that shakes the three worlds. Does this manifest into physical movements of the earth, and will they kill people? Haiti and China. So please don't get enlightened, because we don't want another tsunami on Boxing Day. No, I think it's only when the Buddha becomes enlightened. When other people become enlightened, they don't do earthquakes. So earthquakes are over, so you're quite okay to get enlightened. You're not going to kill anybody. If they do, they're not very wholesome, in my opinion, to become enlightened. There are many incidents in recent times. Are any of them related to someone getting enlightened somewhere, perhaps in a remote area? No, you've been thinking too much. So these days, earthquakes, they are because of the movement of tectonic plates. If any of you study geology, you know that these tectonic plates, they keep on moving, and there's a big rift in the tectonic plates, you know, just in Sumatra, you know, especially West Sumatra, so that, you know, that's always likely to actually to cause earthquakes. But I was always interested in science, and especially geology, because those tectonic plates, two of those tectonic plates were actually the Australasia and also India. Because if you actually look at the history of the movement of the tectonic plates, Australia and India were many millennia ago actually connected. And where Perth is, that was actually right in just that little hollow in India. So many, many centuries ago, actually Perth was actually connected to India. So it's very likely that Kassapa the Buddha walked over the ground of Serpentine Monastery where I live. Which is why it's a very powerful place. That's what I say. It's probably untrue, but nevertheless. "Ajahn Brahm, you really inspired me, and I loved listening to you and read your book. You gave me a different meaning of life, but..." Why do they always have buts? There we go, anyway. "But because I'm still a teenager, and I don't know why, I love keeping precepts and having simple life. However, my friends always ask me to enjoy life, like go to cinema, club, party, etc. There was once I went to the cinema with them and the sound was too loud that my ears hurt. Instead, I love meditating because it's quiet and peaceful. How should I cope with all these? Is it bad to know Buddhism at this young age?" It's saving you a lot of earache. So look, go to the cinema with your friends and wear earplugs. Or even better than that, you can actually have an iPod with one of my talks. So they're watching this stupid movie, and you're listening to this beautiful Dharma talk. And you will find where they always get up to a lot of mischief and get into trouble, you'll be a very peaceful, happy being. Teenage years are very, very difficult, and many people get into a lot of trauma. And you've got to find a partner in life. And a lot of people, you know, you ask them about trying to find a partner, or trying to find a boyfriend and girlfriend, a lot of difficulty. If you're a Buddhist, it's easy. I remember just teaching a youth group over in Singapore. Again, I land at the airport and they just take me straight away to these youth camps and they say, give them a talk. I got no preparation, I don't know what I'm supposed to be talking about. So I saw the boys and girls, you know, about 16 to 20. And so I split up into the boys and girls, split into two, as they did. And then I looked at the boys and I asked them, what do you like in a girl? What does a girl have to do to attract you? And all the girls were really listening. If I'd have talked about Buddhism or the Four Noble Truths and meditation, they wouldn't have listened at all. And you know what the boys said? And I asked them, do they have to be, you know, really beautiful and sexy? They said, well, it helps, but it's not that important. And they were really surprised, because they always thought they had to be sexy and wear really nice clothes and have good hairstyles and stuff like that to attract a boy. And then they said, no, what they really wanted was, you know, someone they could trust and someone who can care for them and someone who's fun to be with. And they realized, actually, that keeping precepts, being trustworthy, and having compassion, being someone who can care for someone else, actually made them attractive. And they realized what they were learning in a Buddhist center was even better than going to a salon or buying expensive clothes. And then I swapped them around and asked the girls, what do you like in boys? Now, do they have to be tough and macho? I said, no, that really turns us off, you know, when they try and be tough guys. What do you want? And say, we want people, boys, who are fun to be with, ones we can really trust. You know, it's amazing. They actually wanted the same sort of things. They didn't want a short-term relationship. They were looking for something a bit more meaningful. And so, you know, to be trustworthy, now, keeping your precepts, to be someone who really is compassionate, someone who's light-hearted, you know, like I am, and is fun to be with. Why are you spending 2 hours every night coming here instead of going home? So when I said that, they realized that they should be better Buddhists, and then they'll have a much easier time of finding a partner. Great. So that's actually what you do. If you keep sticking around here, you'll be able to take your choice of partners. Take the best of the best, while all your friends, they'll be just left with the leftovers. Ajahn Brahm, I went to India for my pilgrimage last month, and there I witnessed the level of poverty that normally moved others to do something, or felt intense pity. Especially for those beggar children, but I just felt that they needed to experience their karma. They were not much different from the animals. Ooh. Is this the right way of thinking? Is this selfishness? Is this equanimity? Does one have to be unmoved in all occasions before being considered equanimous? Now, I've been to India many times, and I remember one time the group who was taking us around the places, they decided to go on the early morning boat trip down the Ganges in Varanasi. I went there to go to Narsana, where the Buddha gave the first sermon. But they decided, let's go on the early morning boat ride. So I went along with them. And after the boat ride, going up and down, you know, a river's a river, no matter what country you're in. So after finishing the boat ride, we landed at the jetty, we had to walk back to the bus. And on the way, because there were very poor people there, there was a group of lepers came out. And they followed each one of us asking for rupee. And of course, one of them attached themselves to me. And they're putting his hand out to me, rupee, rupee, rupee. And I said, look, I'm a monk, I don't have rupee. And then I thought, you stupid Ajahn Brahm, do you think this guy can understand English? No way. So, you know, I understood he couldn't understand English, and I couldn't understand Hindi. I didn't have any rupee to give him. So what I did, I put my arm around him. And he gave me this most beautiful smile. And that stayed with me all that trip and stayed with me ever since. And the reason why it stayed with me, I've never seen anyone in Australia smile like that very often. And I thought, was that guy poor? Materially, yes, he was a leper with open wounds. But he had a spiritual happiness, which I'd love to see people in Australia have. And when I got back to Australia, there was an article in the newspaper about the suicide rate was so high in Australia. Why do people in Australia, with so many opportunities, with great schools, great hospitals, great wealth, why are they killing themselves? Whereas in India, in Benares, suicide rate is far less. I'm wondering, who are the poor people and who are the wealthy? Sometimes in India, it's because of the culture. Yes, they may have nothing, but they know how to enjoy nothing. Enjoy themselves, enjoy. Obviously, it's not good enough just to say, oh, they're enjoying themselves, I'm not going to help. They still need the material sustenance. But I realize Australia is also in great need of spiritual sustenance. And the same here in Malaysia as well. You are physically wealthy, but how many people get depressed or on medication? How many people are suicidal or actually commit suicide? Why can't we just smile like the Indian guy who had no money at all, who was a leper living out on the streets? But when he smiled, he saw this beautiful, beautiful inner happiness, even though he was so poor. He had something. And I think that's something which people in rich countries have forgot is really important. So that's actually my experience there. And of course, you know, you want to help out as much as we possibly can. Nimitta is not mentioned often in the suttas, at least the one that I have read so far, i.e. Digha Nikaya, Majjhima Nikaya. Why is there so much emphasis on Nimitta during the retreats, except in Vipassana meditation retreats? In the suttas, Vipassana is not mentioned hardly at all, about 3 or 4 times. Jhana is mentioned every other page. But the Nimittas is actually mentioned there. There's a few, 3 or 4 times, mostly in the Anguttara Nikaya. But remember the Nimitta, when it comes up, that's a reflection of your citta. So actually, in Anapanasati Sutta, they call it the citta, because actually how it appears. The Nimitta is the side of the citta. So that's actually what it really means. But that's a meditation question, a technical question. We can go into that tomorrow if you really want to. I just lost my mother 2 months ago. She meant everything to me. Mum, advisor, friend, well-wisher. Now life feels empty, meaningless. I see no reason to live.
Please tell me, show me the way out of this pain and misery. Thank you. I would have told the story on the last talk about death, but you ask it now. My father died when I was only 16. And for those of you who've been following my talks, you notice how much I respected and loved that man. He was a great father to me. And again, he was one of those role models which made me who I am today. And if I'm a good teacher, my father takes a lot of credit for that. So, I was 16 when he died. He died at home. I was woken up in the middle of the night. My mum said, I can't wake your father. So I went to shake him. He was dead. He felt him. And he was cold. Dead. I never cried. I never felt sad. Never cried since. And for me, loving someone so much and feeling no grief was weird. So weird that when I became a monk, I kept on thinking, what was going on? What did I really feel? And again, because emotional intelligence is getting in contact with these weird and strange emotions and understanding them. Again, that's some of the things which I got from the Down syndrome kids. Getting in touch with my emotions and understanding what was happening. So I looked at that, felt it, investigated it, and of course I came up with this great simile. The simile of a concert. I loved music when I was a young man. With all sorts of music concerts, and whenever the concert was finished, we always had the encore. As I said a few days ago, I think I mentioned the story already. And after the encore was finished, I had to go out of the concert hall or pub or auditorium to go home. And after every great concert, I went to wonderful concerts. Concerts I can still remember right now. After the end of a great concert, I never cried. I never felt sad after a wonderful performance. Instead, after a great performance, I felt privileged, grateful to have been there at the time. How lucky I was to have seen such amazing music. Even though I knew it was ended, I won't be able to hear it again probably. I felt so blessed. And that's exactly how I felt my father died. Blessed to have known a great man for 16 years. Privileged to be his son. So grateful I could spend those years with him. I never felt sad. I felt so lucky. Now look at your mum's life. Don't know how many years you've had with her. You're so lucky to have been with her. Feel grateful. What a marvellous life that was we had together. Why are you feeling sad? You should feel so blessed, so lucky. Thank you, Mum, for being there for such a long time with me. I would have never given that up for the whole world. Thank you so, so much. Just by the end of a great concert, you never cry. You never feel sadness. You feel the beauty of gratitude. True meditation begins, as you mentioned to us, whatever we experience, we make peace with it, be kind with it. How do we be kind of being feeling sleepy? Go to sleep? Yeah, be kind of it. Being sleepy is not breaking your precepts. At least when you're sleepy, you're not talking, so you're keeping the noble silence. So you can't do much mischief when you're asleep. So you're being kind is realizing that your brain needs some sleep. Your brain is telling you, look, I'm dull, I'm sleeping. And you're fighting the nature of your brain. If you fight with nature, that's called suffering. You know what someone asked me? It was in Singapore. You know what Singapore people are like? I hope there's not too many here because I'm getting trouble. In Singapore, someone asked me, look, can you please explain to me the meaning of suffering? Quick. So I said that suffering is asking from the world what it'll never give you. Asking for what you can never get is called suffering. So if you ask, you never sleep in meditation, you're asking for something you can never get, which means you will suffer. So instead of asking for what you never can get, just be peace with life. Don't try and make it how you want it to be. To be free of suffering, you have to change what you want to be in line with what life gives you, not the other way around. So if you're sleepy, I'm happy to be sleepy. If you're sick, I'm happy to be sick. If I've got energy, I'm happy to have energy. Then whatever you experience in life, you don't suffer. If you want things to be different, suffer, suffer, suffer. Stupid, stupid, stupid. And what do we have to do to let it go? Thank you for all the guidance. Stop being control freak. Just stop doing things. Stop controlling it. There's this little person inside that controls. It's like the mouse of your mind. You know, just always clicking this and clicking that, and ordering this and ordering that. Disconnect the mouse of your mind. Cut the cable so you can't do anything. That's called letting go. There, these are different types of merits, or different between offering dana to a senior monk versus a junior monk, or monks versus nuns. Thank you. The Buddha actually said, if you offer the dana to an Aryan, to an enlightened monk, it's far more bang for your bucks. You get far more returns for your investment. So if you give like an £1 to an arahant, wow, you get so much back in return. If you just give it to a scallywag buck who's nowhere at all, then it's, you know, you don't get much back at all. So that's why people want to know who the arahants are. If he's not, I'm not going to give any references to him. That's one of the reasons why we never say. And instead, the Buddha gave a beautiful answer. He said, much, much better than even giving a robe to a Buddha is giving it to the Sangha. Much, much better than giving it to the Sangha of monks is giving it to the jewel Sangha of monks and nuns. The Buddha was so wise, he said, don't give it to individuals, give it to the Sangha, the monastery, the temple. So whichever monk or nun needs it can make use of it. That's the highest way of giving gifts. And that way you don't have to know which one is in light, which one isn't. Just give it to the Sangha, give it to the monastery. That's the very highest. Beautiful answer of the Buddha. Is it true only when one has a good, pure heart, one is blessed with good things in life, house, car, jobs, friends, money, etc. What do you mean they're not the good things in life? House and car and job and friends and money, they're the hindrances in life. I haven't got any of those things. And I am blessed. I haven't got a house, I haven't got a car, I haven't got a job. I haven't got money either. I'm glad I've got friends, I've got that one. That's a good thing in life. Everything else, house, car, jobs, money, etc. That's not really good things in life. So why do people say hurtful words, even if they say such piercing words? How do I not become hurtful? If those words are unkind words, how do I not react to what people say? It's why you've got two ears. One to go in, one to go out. So when they say bad words, it goes right the way through, goes out the other side, you don't keep anything. However, many of you keep all the bad words. They call me a pig. Why do they call me a pig? I'm not a pig. And they've now called you a pig 3 more times, every time you remember it. So if someone calls you a pig, go, oink, oink. Then you don't get upset anymore. Why do some people have a peaceful death and others do not? They suffer for a long time with illness, but they had done good in their life, prayers, dharma, etc. Actually, I remember just going from Taipei to Penang many years ago, and I think it was Dr. U. Remember Dr. U? He was actually driving the car, and there was this woman in there who was an oncologist. And she said an amazing thing. She said she was about to retire, forget her name, and she said, now I've been watching people with cancer for such a long time. He said, so Buddhists always die peacefully. The other religions don't. That's what she said. She was actually being quite honest. And I've seen that as well in my life. Because the Buddhists, you know, we're not so worried about death. When you get reborn again, it's not the end of the world. Dying's a big deal. We've done it many times before. So just here we go again.
And reborn very quick.
Yes, I'm doing reborn very quick. Go back again. Well, look, maybe your old grandma or your old grandfather's body is like the old bomb of a car. It should have been recycled a long time ago. That's what it's doing with his body. So you don't want to keep going on with this really old body which is sick and falling apart. And you've got a new one coming. So, you know, that's what good Buddhists have done, lots of good karma. So they know that this old body of theirs, it's really awful, but they've done lots of good karma, lots of donations, lots of precepts, meditating, which means in their next life you're going to get a Rolls Royce of a body. If you're a woman, supermodel. If you're a man, better than Brad Pitt. Because you've had such good karma, you're going to get this incredibly powerful, hunky body in your next life. Something to look forward to. That's my Buddhist. I remember this occasion, this Thai lady who was in Perth for many, many years. Now she got lung cancer. And as soon as she was diagnosed, she called me up and I rushed to the hospital. And as one of these other girls would laugh at the diagnosis, terminal cancer, she had 4 kids. Yeah, 4 kids. And the youngest one was about 7. Was a little bit autistic. She had no husband, single mother, really a great mother. And she was diagnosed with lung cancer, maybe 2 or 3 months to live. And so I went to see her, and she was totally at peace. And so she spent all the time just discussing the funeral arrangements. She was a Thai lady, and she was telling me jokes. She said, If any of the Thai people want to come and see me, tell them to wait till I'm at my box. Then they won't disturb me. So let them see me in my coffin, not in the hospital. And after talking to her, making all the arrangements for the funeral, as I was walking out, the head nurse grabbed me by the arm and pulled me into a room. So I'm so glad you've come. That woman you've just seen, she's in denial. She hasn't really sunk in yet, and she's dying. So what do you mean? She just discussed her funeral with me. She can't have done. She's not crying. She's not upset. I said, look, this is what Buddhists are like. But not like, she was an Irish, not like the Christians and the other people who get just totally over the top when they're dying. So you don't have to cry. And you know, this was, I think she was actually the matron of the hospital, because that's what she told me. She said that was the first time she'd ever seen someone who was diagnosed with terminal cancer with such a short time to live, with four young kids, be so peaceful with her death. And at her death, her GP, who was a Christian, he kept on saying that she died with grace, one of the best deaths he'd ever seen. Why was that? Because she was at peace with things. She let things be. She wasn't fighting inevitables. She died so well. She was a very good Buddhist. So, if you really understand your Buddhism, you meditate, you keep your precepts, your death is going to be beautiful. And you don't struggle at all, and you have a very, very peaceful time. Sometimes I thought that Christianity, why do they struggle so much? And I sort of thought about that. In Christianity, you only have one life. That's what they believe. At the end of this life, you have the biggest examination ever. One chance, heaven for eternity, or hell for eternity. And hell, total torture, with no sort of way out, forever and ever and ever. If ever you have been nervous for an examination, imagine how nervous you would be on an examination whose states of eternal happiness or eternal hell. No wonder Christians are just so scared when they die. And of course, no one is that perfect. No one is that perfect that they're sure they're going to go to heaven forever. They've all done bad things. Some little bad things, some naughty things. So you can imagine, if you really believe that, I sort of try to empathize with a Christian who really believes that, the death is terrifying. Terrifying. You're going to have the big exam. It's not just going to university or failing. It's not just getting the job or not getting the job. It's not passing the driving test or failing. You have one go, and if you don't pass, torture. Forever and ever and ever. My goodness, that would scare the pants off anyone. Anyway, I'm currently going out with a guy. For 1 year plus now, he is very much younger than me, although he had constantly reminded me that he loves me very much and will never betray me, and indeed he has been a perfect boyfriend. But somehow inside my mind, I always worry that the age difference is that he will not be experienced enough to go through life with me. Am I thinking too much? Yes, you are. The age is not important, it's just the quality of the person is important. So if he really is a good guy, and you know, he really is honest, and he just keeps his precepts, and he's a really good guy, you're very lucky. So you know, don't sort of give him up, you know, too quickly just because he's not the right age. You know, you're not that sort of beautiful, you can actually make too many choices. So if you get a good one, take it. How does transfer of merits help our departed loved ones? Is there a time limit from the time of death to the time of transfer of merits? It's usually the case that if they've already got reborn in, say, the heaven realm or in the human realm, of course you can't transfer merits. Because if in the heaven realm, it's like sending a donation to Bill Gates. So that's like transferring merits to someone who's in the heaven realm. Total waste of time. But if in the ghost realm, it's like, you know, like sending some money to one of those poor people in India. They really appreciate it. So it really depends on where they've been reborn. So how it works is that, you know, if they were a loved one, then when you think of them, there's always a connection. The old story that if your, say, son who may be in New York has an accident this afternoon, you're the mother, him in KO, you know that something's wrong. You know there's been an accident. And you're separated by thousands of miles, and you know there's always a connection between loved ones. Because of that, you also know that that connection is the way you can transfer memories. If you're thinking of them and you really want them to be happy, you made the merits of karma, they know, and they'll be able to receive those merits. That's the mechanism by which it works. The same mechanism that an accident with a loved one, the other side of the world, you know it here in Pichai. An unmarried relative has a 4-year-old son. The boy has never seen his father and has started asking questions about his father. What is the best thing to say to the boy so he doesn't grow up insecure? What should the mother do? Sometimes honesty is usually the best policy. So be honest and tell him that, sort of, you know, that we did work out, so the father's somewhere else in another country or whatever. And, you know, maybe later on you'll be able to see your father. But don't tell him that his father doesn't exist, that he was what's it like immaculate conception. He's got a father, so let him know. Because usually children are much smarter than you expect. I told a few of the monks last week in my monastery that when I was about 4 or 5 years of age, we had a budgerigar in our apartment, a pet, called Bluey. I still remember his name. And then one day Bluey disappeared. And I asked my dad, what's happened to Bluey? And my dad said, he's gone on holiday. I knew my father was lying. He died. He was a 4-year-old. I knew he died. But my father, just because he didn't want to hurt me, lied and said he'd gone on holiday. I know that kids are far smarter than you expect. So tell your kid, be honest with him, and he would always respect you for that. May I ask if one could do meditation, relaxation, or chanting or prayer when one lies down in bed during sleep time? Is it disrespectful to do that? No, you can actually do it lying down, because one day you'll be sick, you'll be dying in bed. And it's great. That's why you should keep out of bed as much as you possibly can. It's the most dangerous place where most people die. So if you can learn how to meditate in bed, it means that when you actually are really dying, you can meditate and have a nice death. Or you can chant. So yeah, please do it when you're sort of lying down, but please don't do chanting, especially loud, this evening in the dormitory. Other people want to go to sleep. Right, 2 more questions and then we finish. That's pretty good, 10 o'clock. What inspires you to become a monk? Why do you choose Venerable Ajahn Chah as your teacher? What inspired me to become a monk? So I already told you that I got dumped by my girlfriend. So I became a monk to forget. Well, I'm afraid it wasn't that romantic. Because what inspired me to become a monk, obviously, because deep meditation, a lot of this, that was actually the main course. I thought, my goodness, why is meditation so happy? And I wanted to explore that more. And in Thailand, you can become a monk temporarily. So I thought I was at a time of my life, I was free from family commitments, and I had a good career in front of me, I could take a year or two off, and really try and find out about meditation, the nature of my mind. Of course, as soon as I became a monk in Bangkok, it was a strange experience, and no exaggeration, as soon as I put on those robes, I knew that this was for life. Literally, that this was who I was. And for the first week, I would have nightmares. And my nightmare, I'd wake up in the middle of the night in this monastery in Bangkok in a sweat. Because my nightmare was, I thought I was a layperson. And I'd look at the robes next to my bed. I'm a monk. And I'd turn over and go into a very peaceful sleep. And that's actually true. That's actually how much I wanted to become a monk. So that's me, that's who I am. So I never look back. And I told people at the time, I said, I'm a monk forever. They said, yeah, everyone says that. You just go with me. And say, now look at me now. So that's actually why I became a monk. Why did I choose Ajahn Chah as a teacher? Well, I was an English monk. You know, and English people like tea. And the word for tea is cha. Anyone with a name or a tea is a monk, the English monks. Okay, if they were done to have perfect sila and perfect concentration, had he not entered the stream, and thus would not fall into the lower realms. But he did go to the hell realm after his attempt at killing the Buddha. Shouldn't a person who attains perfect sila and perfect concentration become an anagami? Why your wool was not rooted out in Devadatta's case? Because he didn't have perfect sila. But no, he had good concentration, he had samadhi, but his sila was not really good enough, and his wisdom was weak. Because he hadn't really seen non-self, and he thought that I had made that attainment, I was Kapajanas, and I am a great monk, look at me, I can do all these amazing psychic things. And it was because he added this I to those attainments. He thought it was really him, and that's why he became conceited. So remember, these aren't attainments, not something which you gain. It's all about what you let go of and what you lose. You remember that in meditation, how much we can get rid of things. Then we get a smaller I, never a bigger I. And that way we never get into trouble or problems. But if you make a bigger I, if at the end of this retreat you go and ask your friend, what did you get? And they said, oh, I got nimitta. Oh, nimitta, I got that the first day. I got first jhana. Then you're not a Buddhist. Just looking at this as just another competition to see who can get the most. This is not spiritual materialism. This is learning how to let go. So, that's the last of the questions. So we've got 5 minutes left. Any question from the floor?
Could you elaborate more on Nibbana?
Elaborate more on Nibbana. I already said it's the end of all wanting. Peace at last. Have you ever felt peaceful? This is actually a good question. In your life, everybody in this room, when have you felt the most peaceful? When have you felt just the most deeply happy? For most of you, it would be a time when you felt so content, where you wanted for nothing, you were just so happy to be here, and you didn't have any want or desire in your mind. That's called a taste from the moment. Imagine you have that all the time. Perfectly at peace and happy with what you have, no matter what it is. Calm, peace, still, cool. Now, of course, that's not going to be a philosophical answer. I'm trying to tie it to your own personal experience. Something you've had. I remember just as a kid, at the afternoon of school, and I finished all my homework during the lunch break. And I remember to this day walking out of those school gates, having nothing to do. No want, nowhere to go, just I can do whatever I wanted. And basically just felt so free and peaceful. That was sort of an indication, almost a taste, a whiff of Nibbana. How much freedom have you got now, sir? Can you just end your job? You've got all these commitments, responsibilities and things you have to do. They're called attachments, and they weigh you down. Imagine being a monk, totally free. That's bliss. Which is why the many of you can always think of becoming monks or not. Before you get tied down and attached. I saw on the, I think on the newspapers, I think in the Straits Times coming up here, there's a movie of Gulliver's Travels. And I saw this guy, Gulliver, tied down with all these ropes. And I thought, that reminds me of many people I know. Tied down with business, with work, with family, with friends, responsibilities. Not free. to stand up and dance through life. As we bind, no ropes, no ties.
I can understand the concept of nirvana in the present world when it still exists, and it's a feeling of peace and contentment. But what about the effect of nirvana in our afterlife, where everything is empty, it don't exist anymore? There's no form, there's no being. So how peaceful can it be when we don't exist at all?
When you exist, you always make a mess of things. When you disappear, it's totally peaceful. No more moving. This thing which you call existing, this I which we think existing, when you understand what that is, you realize that is the problem. When that problem is solved, then you're at peace. Using an example from Sariputta, if you've got a sickness, so when that sickness is healed, do you feel happy? It's a happiness because of the end of an affliction. And that's what the Buddha described nirvana as, the end of an affliction. Peace, freedom, happiness, and bliss. Real stillness.
But when we do not exist anymore, how could we feel?
How can we feel? I feel pretty good. So I know your question, but the only way to answer it is actually this. Something which I cannot answer to you unless you actually get into, say, some of the jhana experiences. It's too far away from the personal experience. So when you actually start to disappear, this is actually when the ego and the self starts to vanish. Your idea of who you think you are gets more and more ephemeral, more misty, just like a rainbow in the sky. You know, it's there, but it's not really there. You can push your hand through it. It's just reflections. But when you actually get that close in the deep meditations, you get closer to Nirvana, and then you can understand it. Which is why the Buddha could never explain it more than that. He said, come to this deep meditation and you can see it for yourself. That's as far as I can really tell you. Further than that, deep meditations is where you really get the taste of Nirvana. I'm not trying to sort of pop you off. Just saying, you really do need to have those experiences before you get the deeper teachings.
How difficult would that be?
If you don't come on the retreat, impossible. So it can be done. People do get the jhanas. Even on this retreat, that people have told me, like, I know one person told me about her experience and it was a jhana. So people do it. It's actually, it surprised me at first. I thought only monks and nuns could do these jhanas. But teaching meditation, I thought, why not give people a chance, lay people, something to do it. So, it can be done. But to be able to do it, you really have to do a lot of letting go. But the only place you can do that is when you come on a retreat or go to a monastery for a few weeks. Can be done. Okay, so, okay, last question, because Nirvana is about the ending of all things. It's about time to end this evening. So last question, we finish up again.
Can you elaborate? Wisdom, insight, mindfulness.
Wisdom, insight, mindfulness. Okay, some of these words, they overlap. So you need mindfulness to get insight, and insight makes you wise, and wise means you can be more mindful. So they all work together. Basically.